A judge authorizes the first Exxon Valdez plaintiff checks.
And that's just the first wave, the initial wave. There'll be a series of waves. I think this is just hopefully opening a floodgate.
From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 24th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, environmental groups keep a close watch on proposed Bush administration changes to the Endangered Species Act.
It seems to be focusing more specifically now on excluding any sort of consideration of global warming impacts on wildlife from Endangered Species Act protection.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
A federal judge in Anchorage today has ordered the distribution of the first round of payments from the Exxon Valdez oil spill punitive damages case. KMXT's Jay Barrett has more.
Judge H. Russell Holland signed an order directing the administrators of the Exxon Valdez settlement to start making payments. Between a third and a half of the plaintiffs should be receiving checks soon after Thanksgiving. Frank Mullen is a fisherman and financial planner in Homer who has followed the case closely.
The attorneys have said that they're going to be aggressive about cutting checks and getting a distribution made here. So Merry Christmas, everybody.
Andrew Ott is a plaintiff's attorney in Kodiak.
Yes, we are happy. Judge Holland authorized distribution of the initial application for distribution. So a lot of Kodiak fishermen, as well as Prince William Sound and Cook Inlet and natives, will be receiving money shortly, probably right after the Thanksgiving holiday.
The first payments will go to the 13 claimant classes listed in Exhibit C, which appeared in a dozen lists posted on the Anchorage Daily News' Highliner blog a couple weeks ago. They include Cook Inlet, Prince William Sound, and Kodiak salmon fishermen, along with two native categories. Shellfish and herring fishermen are not included in the first distribution. Mullen says some people on the first payout group might not see their names there, but they shouldn't panic.
They most likely still have a valid claim, but the clean claims list does not include anyone who may have had a divorce sometime throughout the years, and there's a claim split because of that. There are a variety of other reasons why, you know, if there's any kind of an IRS lien or anything going on in the background with the claim, you'll be coming along here on list two or three or some other future list.
Ott speculates there will be several rounds of payouts before Christmas.
And that's just the first wave, the initial wave. There will be a series of waves coming out, in particular those people that have asked for voluntary tax withholding and didn't find their name on the initial list will be on a subsequent list so that we can get money out before Christmas to those folks. I think this is just hopefully opening a floodgate.
Because of legislation passed this year, Mullen says plaintiffs have the ability to protect much of their payout.
Through the efforts of many folks in Kodiak and fishermen all across the oil fisheries, Prince William Sound and Cook Inlet and hither and yon, there was a group of oil fishermen that came together and worked on an act of Congress over the last couple of years. And, you know, we raised money, $20 here, $50 there. Fishermen reached into their Carhartts and helped us out, and in the end, we were able to get this piece of legislation through Congress and signed by the president.
Fishermen can put up to $100,000 in an IRA and defer the taxes. They can income average their payments on their tax returns, and they do not have to pay self-employment tax on the payouts. In Judge Holland's order, 5% of each payment will be held back in case Seahawk Seafood's appeal for a recalculation of the distribution is accepted by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Holland rejected Seahawk's request to be given a larger slice of the pie earlier this month. The payments will also be reduced by 22.4% for attorney's fees. For example, a plaintiff scheduled to receive $50,000 will get, after the deduction and the holdback, $36,860. In Kodiak, I'm Jay Barrett.
The Department of Interior is working to finalize a change to the Endangered Species Act. The Bush administration has less than 30 days to complete the new rule to have it take effect by the time President-elect Barack Obama enters office. The Interior Department is calling it a small modification that won't affect the meaning of the law, but environmental groups see it very differently. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The new rule was proposed in August and drew more than 200,000 public comments. Chris Paolino is Deputy Director of Communications for the Department of Interior.
We've received those comments. are reviewing them, and at this point are looking at the proposed regulation, potentially making changes, and before coming to a final decision.
The change would allow individual government agencies to take action on a given project without consulting with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on whether endangered animals or plants could be affected. The proposed rule also focuses on climate change. Paolino says it makes it necessary to demonstrate a direct link between the decline of a species and carbon emissions.
The idea that science at this point cannot track how a particular emission from, say, a power plant in Arizona cannot track the direct impact that those particular emissions have on a species, say the polar bear in Alaska.
Paolino says the rule is aimed at clarifying the process and removing bureaucratic red tape. He says it doesn't fundamentally change the Endangered Species Act.
And it doesn't remove any of the requirements upon agencies or the federal government or anybody to protect endangered species. Ultimately, the strength of the act, which says that there shall not be take of an endangered species, negative impact to an endangered species, remains.
But environmental groups disagree. Andrew Wetzler is director of the Endangered Species Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council. He says the proposed rule eliminates some of the crucial safety checks that have kept thousands of species from the brink of extinction.
Because the Endangered Species Act says that federal agencies can't take any actions that may affect listed species, protected species, unless they first consult with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And this rule essentially allows federal agencies to proceed with actions without doing any consultations. So it contradicts the plain language of the statute.
Wetzler says the Bush administration is ignoring the hundreds of thousands of comments on the proposed rule as they rush to finalize it. And he's concerned about how the rule may have evolved since it was first proposed this summer.
The rule has changed a bit from what we've been able to tell, although we won't know for sure until the final regulation is published. It seems to be focusing more specifically now on excluding any sort of consideration of global warming impacts on wildlife from Endangered Species Act protections.
An outgoing administration usually has to finalize a new rule 60 days before leaving office. The Interior Department missed that deadline Friday, but the department has classified this rule as minor, so it only needs 30 days to take effect. Wetzler says if that does happen, the rule can be overturned.
Congress still has the option of vacating the rule through something called the Congressional Review Act, which allows Congress to essentially yank any regulatory changes that happen within 60 session days of the end of a particular Congress.
With a failing economy, it's unclear whether the new Congress would have the political will to overturn the rule. The incoming Obama administration could also write a new rule that would undo the changes, but Wetzler says that would be a lengthy process. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Congress is in recess after last week's lame duck session, but for senators and representatives who will return to Congress in the new year, the next month will be a time to work out priorities. Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski is slated to hold her party's ranking spot on the Energy Committee. She spent part of last week meeting with fellow committee members and the outgoing ranking member, New Mexico's Pete Domenici, who's retiring from the Senate. Murkowski says she and her staff are working on their goals for the 111th Congress. But she says everyone's top priority will be sorting out the nation's current economic problems.
When we talk about what we want to do with health care, for instance, or perhaps on some kind of climate change policy, so much of it is dependent on having a strong economy. So we've got to make sure that we're shoring up the economy and working to build on that so that we can do the things that will be so important to provide for the health and the education and just the well-being of people around the country.
Last week, Congress did not vote to bail out the big three automakers, despite much discussion of the crisis state they're in. The House and Senate will likely be called back in 2 weeks to address it, and they've asked the major automakers to present a plan at that time. Murkowski says last week's brief session didn't really amount to much.
To use the teenage terminology, this lame duck session is really lame.
But Murkowski says she was not a proponent of acting quickly or rashly on a new bailout. She says even though she's concerned about the auto industry because of its close connection to jobs and the economy, she doesn't think giving the automakers billions of dollars without stipulations is the solution. Murkowski says there are other industries in dire straits, and the government risks putting itself in a position of constantly doling out money.
This is not the approach that I believe that we should be taking as a government. You know, federal intervention should be the last course of action and not the first. And it seems like that's just kind of what everybody's gearing up to do, is lining up to hopefully get some of what may be dropping off the federal truck here. That's not an appropriate and a responsible course.
Some in Congress have proposed using part of the $700 billion recently dedicated to deal with the banking crisis, but Murkowski doesn't think that money should go to the auto industry. Instead, she's among a group that's looking at redirecting $25 billion in loans the auto industry received to help make more fuel-efficient cars in September.
Now, that was designed to help them retool, if you will. I do believe that we can be a little more creative with how we direct how those monies should be allocated.
Some members of Congress opposed to another $25 billion loan say the automakers may need to declare bankruptcy, and that declaring Chapter 11 would lead to reorganization, which could be helpful. Murkowski says that may be a viable option, as long as a messy, chaotic bankruptcy is avoided. She says real change needs to happen in the auto industry before Congress chips in. Otherwise, there's no point in giving the big three money if it's just delaying an eventual crash. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Iraq war protester from Sitka loses his court appeal.
Well, there has never been a significant social change in the United States that did not include civil disobedience.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by the new AT&T, your world delivered.
A winner could be determined tomorrow in the State House District 7 race. Incumbent Republican Mike Kelly has a one-vote lead over Democratic challenger Carl Castle. Tomorrow, the Division of Elections will count the only remaining ballots from the November 4th election, those sent in from outside the country. State Election Systems Manager Shelley Groden in Fairbanks says all overseas ballots mailed and received within the proper time frame have been sent to Juneau for tomorrow's count.
If their ballot was postmarked on or before Election Day and mailed from overseas, they had until November 19th for us to receive those ballots. I have been given a number of approximately 49 ballots from overseas voters that can count in the House District 7 race.
Groden says if the race is a tie, the division will conduct a recount. The losing candidate or a group of 10 registered voters can also request a recount. She says if after the recount the race remains a tie, a winner will be determined by a rare coin flip, a procedure first employed by the state 2 years ago.
It happened in 2006 in a House race after a primary election. We ended up with a tie vote. For the first time ever, the division flipped the coin to determine who would go on to the general election ballot.
In that case, Bryce Edgman won the coin toss over fellow Democrat Carl Moses. This year's close District 7 race aside, Groden says the State Election Review Board is in the process of checking the validity of every vote logged in anticipation of certifying the election by December. The results are not official until that happens. The Alaska Court of Appeals has upheld the conviction of a Sitka man arrested for an act of civil disobedience in Ted Stevens' Anchorage office last year. Don Muller was charged in February of 2007 with criminal trespass after he and several others entered the senator's office to read the names of the 3,200 U.S. service people and 6,000 Iraqi civilians known to have been killed up to that time during the war. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Mueller had appealed his conviction on technical grounds, namely that he was entitled to what is known as a necessity defense, and that Anchorage District Court Judge Jane F. Kavar failed to instruct the jury appropriately. Senator Stevens was not in Anchorage at the time of the demonstration. Although Mueller was surprised to learn that the appeal failed, his passion for ending the war has not diminished.
I mean, look, who are the criminals in this case? A small group of us who went to Ted Stevens' office to try to stop the war? Or Ted Stevens, who has funded billions and billions and billions into the war, still supports a war? It's a war that's nearly universally seen as illegal, immoral, corrupt. It's bankrupting the United States. Who are the criminals?
In a necessity defense, a defendant has to prove that the harm he hopes to prevent outweighs the crime for which he is charged. Defendants generally have to introduce evidence that there was no reasonable alternative to their action and that the perceived harm meets an objective standard. In other words, a judge or jury or any other person has to see the circumstances in a similar light. Mueller's attorney, Jim McGowan, says the appeal lost on the objective standard.
And that's the weighing of whether the disruption is justifiable in light of the likelihood of this protest having any effect on the war itself.
McGowan says that the appellate court did not dispute Mueller's own or subjective belief that his refusal to leave Senator Stevens' office would lead to an end to the war. The necessity defense allows a defendant to be mistaken in his beliefs, although McGowan argued that Mueller's stance is in no way implausible or mistaken.
You know, it's a function of how many people go into how many congressmen's offices. Don's the lead in the parade. I mean, it's the war will stop when enough people say it's got to stop, and they're not allowing Don to use the necessity defense because he's one of the vanguard of protesters. You know, that's Don's lot in life, I suppose, is to lead the charge, and the first couple guys always get picked off, but when everybody stands up and says no, it'll stop, and then the necessity defense might be recognized.
The Alaska Appellate Court cited several other cases to support its ruling. In one, Cleveland versus Anchorage, anti-abortion protesters sought to raise the necessity defense after they were charged with criminal trespass for disrupting the operations of an abortion clinic by blocking the doors. In another, State of Hawaii versus Marley, defendants were charged with criminal trespass for entering the offices of Honeywell Corporation in an effort to stop what they believed were war crimes being committed by Honeywell. In neither case was the necessity defense allowed since the defendant's actions, quote, were not reasonably designed to actually prevent the threatened greater harm. But Don Mueller remains convinced that civil disobedience is the only effective mechanism for ending the war.
Well, there has never been a significant social change in the United States that did not include civil disobedience and civil resistance and nonviolent direct action. That's historical fact.
The failure of his appeal cost Mueller the $1,000 fine he paid upon his conviction. He says he plans to appeal his case to the Alaska Supreme Court. Attorney Jim McGowan says rejecting the necessity defense was a value judgment of the three appellate court judges, that disrupting the orderliness of Ted Stevens' office outweighed the necessity of ending the war. McGowan would like to see if the Alaska Supreme Court shares those values or shares Don Mueller's. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Fairbanks City Mayor Terry Sterl wants to delay a proposed annexation. The City Council is set to apply to the Local Boundary Commission to expand city limits to take in a Fred Meyer store on the west side of town to gather property taxes from the megastore. Mayor Sterl wants the proposal she co-sponsored with Councilman Chad Roberts to be postponed while voters consider a switch from a property to a sales tax to support the city.
I've had discussions over the past couple months with several members of our community, lots of members, in fact, about the potential for a sales tax in our community, which would virtually eliminate city property taxes. And so we didn't want the two issues to become convoluted and intertwined.
Stirl says if the proposed 3% sales tax passes, it would eliminate Fred Meyer concerns about a property tax hike. She acknowledges some people might opt to shop outside the city to avoid the tax, but that it would exempt food, home heating fuel, medicine, and medical care. There would also be exemptions for small vendors and senior citizens. City voters have repeatedly rejected sales tax initiatives in recent years.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Support for APR and coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
The uncertain future of natural gas development in the state has stalled a Fairbanks company's plan to truck the resource off the North Slope. Fairbanks Natural Gas has a supply contract with ExxonMobil and plans for a liquefaction plant at Prudhoe Bay to supply Fairbanks by tanker truck. Fairbanks Natural Gas President Dan Britton says the LNG project is on hold until a range of gas pipeline projects are sorted out.
The Bullet Line, Angda's proposals, all those are potential impacts to a large investment on the North Slope.
Fairbanks Natural Gas has been struggling to maintain a consistent supply of gas out of Cook Inlet in recent years. Britton says increased demand for Cook Inlet is forcing the company to keep switching suppliers. Fairbanks Natural Gas went from Aurora to NSTAR in 2006. Britton says it's going back to Aurora as of the first of the year and then to ConocoPhillips in March. The Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly is thinking about forming a fisheries committee to address the needs of commercial fishermen in the area. A handful of borough fishermen addressed the assembly at last week's regular meeting. They asked what assembly members have done lately for fishermen who are currently feeling threatened by actions in both the state legislature and the Alaska Board of Fisheries. KBBI's Casey Kelly reports.
The latest threat is coming from a proposal that the Board of Fish will consider in March. Proposal 379, as it's known, would change the management plan for the Upper Cook Inlet Central District salmon fishery by closing down the drift net fleet in certain areas for 2 weeks at the end of July, no matter how the run is shaping up. Board member Howard Delo proposed the rule in order to get more fish to the Matanuska-Susitna borough, where sport fishermen are complaining about a lack of fish. That doesn't sit well with commercial fishermen, such as John McCombs of Ninilchik. He told the assembly that this isn't the first time Delo has tried to get this proposal through the Board of Fish.
This was thrown out the last time because of his conflict of interest. Many people feel comfortable with percentages. 90% of the dip net fish from the Kenai River go to Anchorage and Matsu residents. 7% go to other areas, while only 3% go to peninsula residents.
McCombs says if the proposal passes, it would amount to a reallocation of the fish from one group to another. He says that's an action which, if it happens at all, should be handled during a Board of Fish meeting that focuses on Cook Inlet, not as a supplemental item on an agenda focusing on Southeast Alaska and Prince William Sound fisheries.
I came here tonight to ask for help. Please form a fisheries committee as a part of the assembly. Write the Board of Fish opposing 379. Advocate for an important borough industry. Send a message to the Board of Fish and the Matsu Borough. Out-of-cycle allocations with no local public testimony breed mistrust and suspicion of a once-dynamic public process.
Steve Vanek, another commercial fisherman from Ninilchik, also challenged the assembly to do something about the proposal. He also criticized a special legislative committee that formed earlier this year to look into the distribution of fish between Upper and Lower Cook Inlet.
When will you take an active part in keeping this industry alive in the borough? You must oppose Proposal 379, oppose any attempts by the legislative task force to further restrict the fishery or to buy us out. I don't understand this borough government that gets upset about Agrium closing and doesn't seem to care about one of the biggest industries in the state, where there's 1,400 and some permits, set nets and drift permits, and 80% of those people who own those permits live here in the borough.
Newly elected borough mayor Dave Carey says he understands the concerns of commercial fishermen. In response to a question from Assemblyman Hal Smalley of Kenai, he said he wouldn't be opposed to forming a fisheries committee.
I believe that it's an ongoing need, and this one item is certainly important, but I would hope so. But to answer your question, absolutely. I am hoping to meet with the President of the Assembly and see how we could possibly have a committee in some way, maybe a task force or whatever is the correct term, to deal with fisheries issues. But yes, sir, on that particular item, I am absolutely available, as well as staff, to deal with this.
If the Assembly would like to form a fisheries committee, it would have to do so by resolution. In Homer, I'm Casey Kelly.
More people are riding the ferry connecting Prince of Wales Island to Ketchikan. That's in part due to a drop in its fuel surcharge, which had driven tickets up by as much as 40%. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Fall is usually a slow time for the ferry Stikeen. The 160-passenger ship sails daily from Hollis on Prince of Wales Island to Ketchikan and back. But this year is different. Bruce Jones is general manager of the Inter-Island Ferry Authority, which operates the ship.
Ridership is up, and it's, you know, almost the end of November, which is almost unheard of, because usually we're down about this time, and things are looking pretty good.
One reason is the lower fuel surcharge. The IFA tacked as much as 40% onto tickets last summer to cover the high price of diesel. That's now down to 15%, making passage more affordable. Another reason is the economy. Len Lawrence is IFA's marketing manager.
We think one of the main reasons is the increase in the number of hunters going to Prince of Wales Island. There's been quite an increase in that type of activity, and of course that is witnessed by the amount of game that we see coming back in vehicles from Prince of Wales to Ketchikan. We think they're doing that in lieu of going south for a vacation.
The extra riders have helped put the IFA in the black. So has the decision to drop a second regular Hollis to Ketchikan sailing, but Jones says he still expects traffic to slow down this winter, which will drain some of that revenue. A bigger challenge will be balancing the books for the IFA's second ship. The ferry Prince of Wales sails 3 days a week in the summer, connecting Kaufman Cove, Wrangell, and Petersburg. But the IFA's northern route has never attracted the ridership of the Hollis-Ketchikan run. Jones says he's asking the state to lend a hand.
I'm telling the legislatures that I'm working with the region ones that, you know, if we're going to sustain that northern run, we really need to have some type of continuing subsidy to rely on every year instead of, you know, starting up in May with the Hail Mary pass and hope everything works out.
Lawmakers gave the IFA $500,000 each of the past 2 years. Jones says he'll ask for $2 to $3 million this year to keep the northern route on track. He's also seeking additional federal funds. A Transportation Department grant came in $1 million short of what was expected last year, but Jones doesn't think that will change anytime soon. The IFA is independent from the Alaska Marine Highway System. It provides the only ferry service to and from Prince of Wales Island. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We'd love to hear your comments about the show. To send us your thoughts, go to APRN.org, scroll down to the bottom of the page, and click on the Contact Us link. Be sure to tell us if we can use your comments on the air, and if so, how to pronounce your name. We had reports tonight from Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Casey Kelly in Homer, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP. Giving back to the community is a priority because so many at BP call Alaska home.
The Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business. And by Alaska Conservation Solutions, providing ways to measure your carbon footprint and reduce your energy consumption at AlaskaConservationSolutions.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.